The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
It hasn't gone away. Will the surge in COVID cases put the lifting of restrictions in doubt? As the dust settles on Budget 2022, did the government make the right calls? Not far enough, DUP lukewarm on European Commission's protocol concessions, and is there a gap in the market for a new political party? We'll have all that and more on tonight's Late Debate. And joining us in studio tonight, we have Donna Co-Leary, Sinn Féin TD for Cork South Central and spokesperson on education, Lisa Chambers, Fianna Fáil Senator and spokesperson on European and Foreign Affairs and chair of the Shannon Brexit Committee, Catherine Connolly, Independent TD for Galway West and Las Cian Corla, and Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent with the Independent Group. We want to hear from you as well, so please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie, or you can tweet to @latedebate_rte. Now, as you heard there in the bulletin, Taoiseach Micheál Martin has said that the trajectory of COVID-19 has taken a wrong turn with a sudden increase in deaths and case numbers. He said this evening that he couldn't guarantee that the restrictions would be lifted on October 22nd right now, and that we will have to wait for further presentation from NPHET. And then later on, I think Leo Varadkar saying that it would be next Tuesday's cabinet meeting where this decision would be taken. Maybe I'll ask you first, Catherine. Do you believe, looking at the numbers that we're seeing in the last couple of days, that we should power ahead with lifting those restrictions next week?
I don't like the word power ahead, but certainly the rising numbers are of concern. I'm just straight out of the Dáil, so I haven't really looked at them.
Yeah.
It is of some concern. I'd like to see the breakdown in terms of vaccination. I'd like to see what's leading to the numbers and where they are, what areas of the country.
Yeah, well, we have a few of those numbers now because some of that data was coming out today. Ronan Glenn telling us that there are 370,000 people who are not fully vaccinated as yet. Because, we've been using that 90% vaccinated and it has sounded great, made us feel very safe, I think. But there's a lot of people out there that, for one reason or another, haven't come forward. Where would you stand on this? Because I see Catherine Martin today saying she thinks the nightclubs should reopen, her sector, obviously, that she's responsible for. And they have been under huge pressure and she's been under huge pressure. But she's saying, I think the line was she understood there was a concern around ICU figures and hospitalizations, but that as it stands, we are still heading for reopening on October 22nd.
Yeah, I mean, that is the position currently. And we had the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party this evening and the Taoiseach was asked about that. And he reiterated what you just played there, that like every other time when we get to a reopening date, we will have an NPHET meeting, Cabinet will take a decision. So it'll be the same process again. The government are concerned about the numbers, but it is important to say that there's no plans at all to roll back on any current things that have reopened. So we're just talking about what was due to reopen on October 22nd. Most of the restrictions have already been lifted. Obviously, we're still wearing our masks and there are still some restrictions remaining. But just in case people are worried that we might be going back a little bit, that's not in the plan at all. I hope we can proceed.
But should we be going back a little bit? I mean, I'm looking at the positivity rates here. Kerry reporting a positivity rate of 16.5%, Waterford 16.5%, Cavan 13.5%, Dublin 10%, Donegal and Monaghan both 12% positivity. 408 COVID-19 patients in hospital today. That's an increase of 6 since yesterday. 69 of these patients are in intensive care. Donica O'Leary.
Well, look, I mean, I suppose we still don't have a recommendation from NPHET, so we'll see what the process entails. There's not a formal recommendation at this point in time. Obviously, public health advice remains, as it has throughout the pandemic, of crucial importance to any decision that's going to be made. Look, I'm on national radio and there's however many people are listening. I would take the opportunity to appeal to anyone who's listening and who's not vaccinated. And there are people who have particular vulnerabilities and understand that, but most of that 300,000 aren't in that category. So I'd appeal to people, if you're not vaccinated, go get the vaccine. It is your choice. Yeah, I accept that. But it has real implications for the whole of society. It has implications for all of us. And I'm thinking tonight, yes, the restrictions that are remaining has an impact on all of us. But most of all, I'm thinking that of the thousands of people who are working, particularly in the nighttime economy, who haven't really worked for the last 20 months. And they're the people I'm thinking of tonight who are trying to decide whether they're going to be working in a week and a half's time.
And do they want to be working in an environment
if we're looking at these kind of numbers in the
community.
Well,
look, I mean, yes, I'm sure the same as any other sector of society, they're conscious of the environment and their own safety. But to be honest, my experience is that if you've been out of work for 20 months, you want to work and they want the opportunity to work. Now, like, that doesn't involve no precautions. Of course, there has to be precautions, and we do have to keep an eye on these numbers. But my hope is, and obviously we're like, you know, you have to take cognizance of the situation in terms of our hospitals. The fact is, our hospitals are so vulnerable because of years and years of underfunding in acute beds and hospital beds. And that's why we're probably more vulnerable than other jurisdictions. But my hope is that we can proceed.
Hugh O'Connell, this came up, obviously, as Lisa mentioned there, at their parliamentary party meeting and indeed at the Fine Gael parliamentary party meeting as well. But, you know, in terms of restrictions, the genie is well out of that bottle now. It's very hard to see any attempt to reintroduce lockdown, you know, at these numbers at least?
Yes. I mean, in fairness, I don't think there's any suggestion at the moment, even from people on the public health side, that we'd be talking about reintroducing restrictions. But I think certainly there's a concern amongst officials around the idea of moving to ease more the remaining restrictions on October 22nd, which is Friday week, given the pattern that's kind of emerged since last Wednesday when the downwards trend of cases started to reverse. And the data is pretty new in terms of, like, it really only kind of came into the hands of public health officials last Friday, I understand. And then they've kind of watched it over the last few days. And Nevo Byrne, the HSE's lead on national lead on testing and tracing, has sort of reported these figures that you quoted there earlier in terms of the positivity rate. And I think they're carrying out around 17,000 tests a day at the moment, with capacity to do up to 20,000 tests per day. I think those indicators are concerning, but they just, NPHET, I think, want to observe the data as well over the next few days to see if there's a clear and consistent trend emerging or whether it's just a blip. And that will inform the meeting on Monday when they meet, and they'll make a decision as to whether to recommend to government to move ahead with their plans on October 22nd or not. But my sense of things, just from kind of talking to people in and around government, notwithstanding the fact there's a kind of a commitment to push ahead at this moment in time with the remaining, with the relaxation of the remaining restrictions. Definitely, I mean, if you read between the lines of what the Taoiseach said this evening, no guarantees. You know, the last time he said that was actually in an interview with me back in June 22nd, I think, when it was about reopening indoor hospitality. And they ended up delaying that decision, government, and bringing in the vaccine pass system, which has obviously worked. And even this evening, there were calls at the Fine Gael parliamentary party for that system to be extended through the winter months, given that there's a 92% vaccination rate. And the system, you know, notwithstanding the controversy that it generated at the beginning, has worked reasonably well.
There's a tweet here, Catherine Connolly, and I know you would have supported zero COVID, if I recall correctly, at the height of this. But I see a tweet here. Come on, we have the highest uptake of vaccines in Europe, yet we have the highest number of daily cases. So what are we doing wrong in Ireland compared to Europe? Maybe the government haven't put in place real mitigation measures compared to other EU countries. Now, that is a really good question, actually, because if you look at our vaccination rates, you know, notwithstanding the numbers we were talking about that remain to be vaccinated, we have very high rates compared to other EU countries, and yet our case numbers seem to be...
Well, yeah, actually, when you asked me the first question, the reason I asked about vaccination was everybody is entitled not to be vaccinated. And notwithstanding that, most people have opted for vaccination. And my question and my issues are exactly what that listener has said. How has it happened that we have numbers? I believe that we put all our eggs in the one basket in relation to vaccination. We stopped lots of things when we put our eggs in the one basket. And we stopped in relation to testing and tracing. We stopped in relation to public health aspects. How we're going to have to live with this. Yes, I was absolutely somebody who believed in zero COVID, and I believe we were right, and that was we should have taken that approach. That approach wasn't taken, and the approach was taken of vaccination without looking at how as a society can we cope with this pandemic and the next pandemic we're going to face. And the reason we got into trouble in the first place was we had no public health infrastructure whatsoever on the ground. And when this broke in both China and then Italy. We had time to look at it, but our infrastructure was so bad. And then we failed to look at nursing homes in residential areas where most of the deaths occurred, and then with health personnel. And in that, it was all down to absolute failure to have a public health system. And we haven't looked at that since. And actually, we stopped looking at that once that the we put our eggs into the vaccination basket.
Okay, can I just ask you...
Which I never agreed with as the one solution to
the... Okay, and I'm going to raise that with Lisa in one minute, but I just want to go back to your very opening sentence there. You said everyone is entitled to refuse to be vaccinated. Yeah. I just give you a sense of what people are telling us here tonight on this. One texter: I'm sick of hearing of these unvaccinated people. They cannot be allowed to hold the rest of us back. Katie, we need to stop being understanding of these unvaccinated, to stop being selfish. It's a pandemic, so it's not the me, but the us. And then we do have another texter saying, this has nothing to do with the unvaccinated. Those people can't go indoors currently as they have no COVID. Cert, more attempts at division. And this is from a vaccinated texter, they say.
I think
can you understand how people are so frustrated with people?
I'm not sure where that's coming from at this point, because the level of vaccination is absolutely very high compared with any country and compared with other vaccination programs.
Not high enough, though, clearly, to keep our case.
I'm not sure if what's happening in relation to caseloads. I'm not sure how many people are vaccinated who are getting ill. I don't know the breakdown of that. I've arrived here from the Dáil and I see that the figures are up. I have absolutely no breakdown. My own personal experience...
Two out of every three people in intensive care are not vaccinated, okay. Ronan Glenn told us today.
My personal experience of people who have been very sick in the past while have been vaccinated.
Well, I'm just telling you now, two out of every three people currently in intensive care are not vaccinated.
I'm not arguing, which I'm simply saying my experience on the ground. So it's a little bit more complex. What's going on in terms of vaccination and people getting ill after vaccination. My own family, I have examples of it.
I think people will be surprised to hear you expressing the view that people have a right to be vaccinated. Is there not a public good here that we should be encouraging people to take up the offer of vaccine as it's available?
I have no problem with the public message going out in relation to vaccination. My difficulty was the failure to take other measures along with that, and the failure now to analyse what's happened, and the failure to look at how we got into the mess in the first place. Obviously, it was a pandemic. Absolutely no difficulty with that. But the lead into that, the learning from that, there was a cross-party report which made recommendations unanimously in relation to what happened in nursing homes and residential centres. Never followed up on. Absolutely never followed
okay.
up on.
Lisa Chambers, there is something going on here. If we have these high vaccinated rates and we still now are in this situation where we're seeing a surge and a spike again in hospitalisations and in case numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite frustrated at people that are not getting a vaccine, that have been offered one and have no good reason other than they just don't want to take it. I think it is quite unfair, and it's probably not popular in some cohorts to say it. And I'll probably get an onslaught of social media tweets telling me how terrible I am for suggesting that it's not the right thing to do. In my view, the right thing to do is to take a vaccine unless you have a medical reason that you can't.
Let's park that for one moment.
In the public interest. In terms of the numbers, I'm going to caveat my response by saying I'm not a public health expert. I'm a lay person with the knowledge that we've all picked up. From what I can see from the numbers, because we've all been studying them for so long now, yes, the numbers of those with COVID are increasing over the last number of days. But those in ICU are relatively stable, actually. 60-something in ICU, not a huge number. So what it appears to me, the vaccine never stopped you 100% from catching COVID, but it did mean that you wouldn't get as sick if you were vaccinated.
I think the issue now is that the numbers in hospital are at that tipping point of 400 that we were told at all times. That's where you start to get very worried, because inevitably, people will end up in ICU once you get those kind of numbers.
Well, that hasn't happened yet, and maybe it won't. What we've always been told is that if you have a vaccine, you're less likely, first of all, to catch COVID. But if you do get it, that you're probably not going to be as sick as you might have been. That seems to be bearing out in terms of the ICU numbers.
The rate of case hospitalisation is now almost doubled at 4.3%. This is the swab numbers today. It has increased for the sixth day in a row, and it's now 137% of what it was last Wednesday.
Yeah.
So,
and as I said,
we're obviously in a different place now.
We are, and there are increased numbers on the wards in hospital, but not huge numbers in ICU just yet. I think we probably have relaxed a small bit, particularly with the high vaccination numbers. I think people were getting back to normal life to a certain extent. So this conversation and the warnings from public health are important, because I think it will make us check ourselves a little bit more and remind us that we're still in this pandemic.
But you didn't respond to any of Catherine's points there of all the other mitigation measures that we just threw out the window, because we said, you know what, we're going to get everyone vaccinated.
I will respond. No problem. You know, Catherine said that we put all of our eggs in the vaccination basket. I'm not really sure what other baskets we had. I mean, I think we all accepted, I certainly accepted that, you know, if we didn't have a vaccine, we were going to be in serious trouble, and that the vaccine was our ticket or our key to getting out of this. And I think it has worked.
For instance, what we've decided to do in terms of testing and tracing and in schools and close contacts and all those other issues, we just kind of just moved on.
Yeah, but the schools issue, okay, we'll take that issue for example. There were a lot of parents saying, you know, that their kids were being sent home for extended periods because they were a close contact of another child who they didn't know who it was. So you're trying to balance that. You're having a child out of school for long periods. That's also detrimental. So that was public health trying to balance the risk of being in school as opposed to taking the child out. And I think that they made the right call to allow a close contact in younger children to stay in the school. So public health measures, I know Catherine said that they were abandoned. They're not. Public health measures are still in place. Have we relaxed a small bit the last trial? We probably have. I don't think we need to panic just yet. And I think, you know, talking about certain failures and how we've handled this, I don't think we've done too badly, actually. I don't know any country in the world that's done better than us in terms of dealing with it. Like, you take New Zealand, for example, who did pursue a zero COVID policy. They're still going in and out of lockdowns.
So, oh, come on now. We have 5,000 deaths here. New Zealand had less than 30.
And you look across the water and they have a lot more than that.
Are you saying that we are doing better than New Zealand?
I'm saying that no country has been perfect in how they've handled it. So
the
point I'm making
is
that we've
done pretty close.
Well, they're still dealing with it.
We're looking at deaths as a metric, and I think it's a pretty good metric.
New Zealand has done very well, but it hasn't been perfect. And I think it's very easy to criticise some of the handling of it along the way. I think people have done their best. I think we've done relatively well. Very good vaccination programme. You look across the water to our nearest neighbour, their death rate is much higher than us. You look up the north,
they
it's much
the
higher.
They have the highest death rate in the world, so I don't really think that's looking, a very good
even
comparator,
on the,
even, to be fair.
Well, a very good comparator is to look at the island of Ireland and the two different jurisdictions. And we have a lower death rate than they do in Northern Ireland. So that's, again, is one measure that's very close
because
to home.
Because it was run from the same policies that had produced the highest death rate in the world in
but
Britain.
But the point I'm making is I think we've done pretty okay, actually. And I think our vaccination programme is a credit to us. And other countries have come to Ireland to ask us how we've done it so well. So just to say, it's important to acknowledge the good work that has been done the last year and a half, particularly for all of those workers that have been at the front line and the HSC and all of the staff who, when they listen to talk about how they failed in their work, I think it's important to point out that actually, I think they've done a good job.
Okay, I'll just give you another flavour here because we're getting a huge amount of texts in on this, actually. I can't be vaccinated due to a blood disease and I want to be so badly, says Jerry in Limerick. Remember what happened after Christmas? Come on, the dogs in the street know we've got a date and everyone knows that the 22nd of October is going to be pushed forward by 3 weeks. That's the way it goes, says James. Hi, Katie, remember last Christmas, the amount of people that are unvaccinated could easily cause the country to go back into lockdown. People have a right not to get vaccinated, but they don't have a right to infect me, says Keith in Dalkey. And this is from the other side of that argument, if you put a gun to my head, I wouldn't take the vaccine. I don't trust Big Pharma or their pimps in the medical profession. They've pumped us full of antibiotics. A position that, unfortunately, you know, a lot of people hold, and that has caused a huge amount of vaccine hesitancy out there. But we won't solve that one tonight, I think. So we will move on to, you know, the dust has settled now on the budget. We had a big budget special in the studio and other studios last night. It was predicated, that budget, on the economy, you know, roaring back into life, you know, doing much better, all the predictions doing much better than we had anticipated after emerging from 18 months of restrictions. What if, you know, things aren't going to go as planned now? You know, just today when you see those figures and people are now saying, oh, we need to talk to Neffet again before we move ahead next week. Could there have been a bad call here? Could there have been this whole gamble be proven to be completely off?
I don't think the budget was a gamble. It's in line with what the Fiscal Advisory Council say is prudent. And they're the independent fiscal advisory.
But sure, the Fiscal Advisory Council don't know what's happening with COVID no more.
No, well, so you can only make a decision with the available information that you have. And obviously you have projections and you anticipate what might come down the track. So this has been a cautious and prudent budget. It is still spending, which is great. And I'm almost amazed that we're in a situation a year and a half, still in a pandemic, but go back a year ago, think where the country was. I don't think anybody could have anticipated the budgetary package that was announced yesterday. Over 700 million for the childcare sector. That's phenomenal. It's so significant. It has never happened before.
Yes. If I was dropping my kids into a creche in the morning, I'd still be paying them the exact same amount at the end of the month.
Important point about the investment in that one was that the first port of call was to stabilise the sector, subsidise wages and freeze the cost of childcare. So that subsidy was actually retained for the childcare workers. That's step one. The next step is to reduce the cost on parents, but that was a really crucial step in this budget.
Okay, Donica, the budget, a lot of talk today about what was in it, or rather what wasn't in the budget for renters.
Look, I mean, I think most of the feedback that I've got is, and it's all in a similar space, is that there are so many families out there who, and individuals who, what is coming in barely matches what is going out. And rent is certainly an enormous one. And like in my own city, rents have gone to 1,300 on average in Cork, way beyond that in Dublin, very significant in Dublin, right across the urban centres. And, you know, people who are renting, like, to a large extent, are being forced to make a choice. They're being forced to make a choice. You either want to live independently or you want to put together a deposit. And you really can't do the two in the vast majority of instances. The example of childcare is a good one. And I think it's a really good example of the problems with this budget. Yes, money was spent, but was it spent wisely and was it spent in a focused way? What the government has done, they've created a pool. We absolutely wanted to see childcare workers dealt with. I've been raising this for 5 or 6 years, but they have a pool of money and they're not quite sure exactly they're going to negotiate. They're not quite sure how they're going to deal with the childcare wages. Whereas we were very clear, what you need to do is you need to take on the wage bill of the childcare workers and a certain percentage of the overheads. And in return for that, the provider reduces costs, the fees to the family by a third this year and by an additional third, so two thirds, next year. So we knew exactly how to make the money count.
So basically you're saying we treat childcare workers like teachers now.
We believe that we pay the wages. It's a public service. I believe it's a public good. Okay, it needs to be treated like a public service.
Let me bring in Hugh O'Connell. Because Hugh, I mean, what was striking, I think, this evening was the backbenchers are becalmed. The government backbenchers.
Oh yeah, massively. I mean, even yesterday, taking soundings from various backbenchers in the across the coalition, particularly some who are more rebellious generally, they were pretty happy and pretty satisfied with what was announced, because I think what the budget did was it kind of spread money all over the place so that everybody kind of got a little bit, but it didn't really solve the fundamental problems that a lot of people are facing, which is why with the budget phone-in with the two ministers on Claire Byrne's, today with Claire Byrne this morning, you know, what were the two issues that came up consistently? It was the cost of rent and the cost of childcare. And, you know, was the government announced something which was perhaps a start in relation to childcare, and there really wasn't anything for people who are paying exorbitant rents in yesterday's budget other than a kind of a commitment that we're throwing loads of money at the situation in a bid to increase supply, because that will ultimately drive down rent. But that doesn't really do anything for, you know, the couple paying £2,000 a month in rent or
£2,500 a month. We trashed that one out well last night, and as it was trashed out in many other studios around the country. Mm. But obviously the backbenchers doesn't feel that this is something they need to jump up and down about.
Well, no, I mean, it isn't, because I think, you know, take the Green Party, for example. I mean, if you look at things, there's a lot of things that they got which are kind of core green policies that, you know, are kind of eye-catching as well at the same time, like particularly the youth travel card. That's something that they're really pleased with, because it's half-price travel for young adults aged between 19 and 23. And that's a measure that will hopefully discourage these people from buying cars and encourage them to use public transports. And it's better for, it's therefore better for the climate. So, you know, there's enough in there, I think. And even I was talking to one Green yesterday who was kind of saying, you know, even the stuff on widening the eligibility and the for disability payments, you know, that is or for carers payments as well. That is something that's really progressive, something that you know will really go down well. And I think I was talking to a backbencher in Fine Gael who was full of praise for Michael McGrath because of that particular measure, you know, allowing carers you know, a greater income disregard. And okay, that's a measure that they felt that Pascal Donoghue you know, didn't implement when they asked him to do it over the last few budgets, but that Michael McGrath was able to go that far.
Catherine, what did you think of the budget?
You know, there comes a point in a political life where you just tire of the constant change of numbers in a budget. And I've stood in three elections, general elections, 2011, which I narrowly missed out on, 16 and 20. And I've repeatedly said in the Dáil that the people are way ahead of us. And they've asked us for transformative change before we declared a climate emergency and before the pandemic. In 2011, the message on the door was, we want to pay taxes, we've no problem, nobody looked for a reduction in taxes. They wanted public services in return. And that has been the constant theme. So I would have thought that this year was the perfect time to look at a transformative budget, given that the ministers, one of them, the first minister, said that the planet is burning. So a full acknowledgement that the planet is burning. So what do we do? And Ireland is part of that planet. How do we tackle that? And in that sense, the budget was very disappointing for me, while there were good news in it. And if I had time, I would go into the good news. But overall, I'd ask, what is the type of society that we want? And I would think that it's time that we challenged economists when they tell us that a little bit can go to, and then the politicians repeat it. We'll give a little bit to childcare. We'll give a little bit to mental health. We'll give a little bit to smaller classes. When what we really want is an economy that serves the people. And so there are basic public services that are absolutely necessary. One is public health, in the sense of public health in relation to a pandemic, and then public health in relation to our hospitals and primary care centres. And it's simply not there. Then in relation to housing, it is not a commodity. It is the most basic unit is a home and security. And it has been treated as a commodity by government after government. And again, in this budget, while we pay lip service to public housing and social housing, the vast majority of money is going into the private market.
Yeah.
And there, on all of those levels, we've utterly failed, in my opinion. So we can tinker around with little, with up and down €5 in social welfare. At the most minimum, it required €10. But if we get into that, we're ignoring the bigger picture as to a more equal society is a healthier society. It leads to a thriving economy and it's better all around. And of course, climate change is just fundamental, or should be, to all our policies. And if we just go back even to, I actually read the National Development Plan last weekend, and the language in it is wonderful in terms of sustainability and empowering communities. There isn't a sign of empowering communities in the rural areas and then the regional areas. One very good example.
Okay, I'm going to have to bring in Lisa yeah, to answer a couple of those points. Sorry to cut across to you, Catherine Connolly. We'll go back to the housing thing. The rent issue, and I know the Taoiseach said today that there would be, that Dara O'Brien will be introducing a rent cap soon.
In the coming weeks, yeah.
In the coming weeks.
Yeah, which is soon.
This
question was asked today. That was the response of the Taoiseach, that in the coming weeks we will have that. And, you know, the Housing for All plan was recently launched. There was a €4 billion commitment for investment in housing, and that was delivered through this budget. So that's a significant investment in housing in the budget. I think it's unfair to say that there hasn't been anything in housing. It's the biggest budget we've ever seen for housing.
No, and then in climate change, we needed a different approach.
So. Yeah, well, yeah. Just it was actually responding to a different point that you hadn't made, Catherine, but you're correct, you hadn't said it yourself. In relation to climate...
go back to the rent cap. Can I just ask you about that? Because obviously... Sinn Féin, and I think yourselves as well, I mean, across the House, there's been calls for rent freezes and rent caps over recent times. And the cry we get back at all times is, oh, you know, it's all easy to say that, but it's unconstitutional. In fact, it's exactly what Micheál Martin said on the 4th of July, I think responding to Catherine Murphy, he said, it's great to call for it, it's just not doable. We've explored all aspects in relation to rent and rent freezes and we've been very clearly advised it's not constitutional. That's just the position.
Well, his position today was that it will be done in 2 weeks' time or 2 to 3 weeks' time. I can't give any more detail on it than that because I'm not in the Department of Housing or I'm not the Minister for Housing. So my information is the same as what the Taoiseach gave to the public today. But the investment in housing is significant. When people say it's going to take extra supply to fix the problem, that's the fact of it. If we don't have more houses or more units, we're going to continue to have problems.
But I think the difficulty people have in relation to that, and I know I saw Rory Hearn doing an analysis of that today, in the Examiner this morning, saying that this idea that we'll build more rental, we'll build more, we'll put more money into the
cost rental model.
The cost rental model, yeah, but they're so small, the numbers there are so tiny, they're not going
and there
to
are
make,
plans to
they are a
that.
Drop in the ocean compared to what, and the money that is going into the actual rental properties that are being built for astronomical rents, and they are actually maintaining rents at the level that are completely unaffordable for any person on any sort of a normal income.
First of all, can I say that I accept there is a massive housing problem and I know people are struggling and I think the government acknowledges that and gets that.
Let me just give you the line. The budget is once again focused on incentivising the market, developers and investor funds. Unaffordable house prices and rents remain government policy. They want to keep rents and house prices high in order to attract institutional funds to build the supply. The assumption is this supply at some point in the far distant future will reduce rents, but it is trickle-down free market economics baloney.
I have great respect for Rory Hearn and his particular views on housing and has articulated those over many, many years. That's not the Housing for All plan. That's not the plan that was launched. There will be public housing built by the state, built by local authorities. That's new. And the first ever cost rental homes were delivered under Dara O'Brien, Minister for Housing. So things are changing, but it is moving slow. These things are difficult to change, but it is happening. And the investment in housing has been significant. And if I can just address the point on climate change, we all know that is the biggest emergency facing the country and facing the world. 700 million in this budget has been allocated to direct capital spending by the Department of Environment for next year alone. It was a significant budget for climate. So I think it's very unfair to say that there was nothing in it to address the biggest issue that we're facing. There was. And there was a lot in this budget for younger people as well. Now, not only was there the free travel pass for the 19 to 23-year-olds, there's now free contraception, a brand new scheme that we never had before.
I wondered about that, actually. Is this Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael trying to court the Sinn Féin vote? Because we do know that that cohort, the 18 to 25, are...
Katie, the reason that policy is
very
there...
Very strongly...
The reason that policy is there is nothing to...
for Sinn Féin.
The reason that policy is there is nothing to do with Sinn Féin. I sat on the Oireachtas Committee on the Eighth Amendment. It was a strong and silly recommendation of our committee that free contraception be rolled out to target crisis pregnancies. That has been a core policy
I was actually thinking
for us.
More about the public transport policy.
But, I thought you were asking about the free contraception scheme.
Well, they're both aimed at a very particular age cohort.
Yes, and there was a key message in this budget and a key priority to actually address youth issues and to say to young people, we know you've struggled the last year and a half and even beyond that, and we want to show this is a budget for you as well. So between youth travel, the increase in the SUSE grant, the increase of the threshold so more people will qualify for a SUSE grant, and you have the free contraception scheme for 17 to 25-year-olds, that's a massive achievement. That was talked about for years. The Irish Family Planning Authority have been asking for that. That was a key recommendation from the last term as well, and that's been delivered now by a Fianna Fáil health minister, and that was nobody thought that would happen, and that's a fantastic achievement for young women in this country, I think. And I think it's worth acknowledging, so I'm probably a little bit outnumbered here, but it is worth acknowledging a lot of the good delivery in this budget. It's not possible to do everything in one budget, but a lot of good stuff was announced yesterday.
Would you agree?
Yeah, look,
there was good stuff.
I have no problem acknowledging the point in relation to contraception. I'd like to see it expanded further, but it is a welcome step. But you talk in terms of the buses and the free buses, or sorry, the half-price buses, it was the Sinn Féin proposal that it would be free. You talk in terms of the rent cap, you talk in terms of the voucher. Look, there are a lot of ideas that Sinn Féin have been talking about for a very long time, and some of that is the stuff around the income limits and the distance limits for SUSE. Look, we believe... I think we know.
She was welcome.
We know that we have influence, and we know that when we bring political issues to the table, it has an impact, and we believe it has an impact on the government. And look, I mean, I believe the fact that we are performing very strongly at the minute is also having an impact on the budget. The thing I would say to people, though, is a lot of these proposals that we bring forward, the government takes them and delivers them half-baked. Whereas if you want the real deal, I think in the next election you should vote for Sinn Féin and get a Sinn Féin government to deliver these programmes and these policies in a comprehensive way. And, like, I mean, the other thing I'd say, you know, COVID and the pandemic has taught us a number of things, but one of the things it's taught us is that a lot of the things that people say are impossible, where the political will is there, they are not impossible. And a rent cap is one of these now that was dismissed, including by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, for a long time as impossible, unconstitutional. But when it comes to it and when the pressure comes on, that's what happens. Now, look, I want to see a rent freeze. Whether that's going to happen, I don't know. Already the 4% limits isn't really working because of a lack of inspection and because there's not enough powers in the RTB. If those things are put in place, of course we will welcome that. But, like, I mean, we need to see the colour of the money here.
Okay, just before we leave the housing issue, the Help to Buy scheme. I was looking back because I was thinking, did I misremember this? Because I thought I remembered some very harsh words from Fianna Fáil when this scheme was being introduced by Fine Gael minister back in 2016. And sure enough, I find Michael McGrath at the time said, the Help to Buy scheme and the easing of the mortgage rules will cause new house properties to increase in price significantly. If presented with evidence, then we can't be expected to stand by and do nothing. He said that in November 2016. And then Barry Cowan in 2017 said, they failed to carry out an impact assessment of the scheme, which was ridiculous in the extreme. It has served no purpose other than to increase prices. It has failed miserably and has only priced people out of the market. Then, of course, in 2019, when it was going to talk about it maybe being lifted, Fianna Fáil were dying to hang on to it. And this week we've been told it's a great bonus that we've held on to the Help to Buy scheme.
Well, to be fair, you're asking me to comment on colleagues' comments from 4 or 5 years ago. I'm not sure what was in their minds at that point, but I think they were working out the information that they had at that point.
And
we can only work out the information
though
that we have today. So your researcher has done a good job at digging up comments from 4 or 5 years ago, but
took me 30 seconds
on
Google.
I can't answer for other colleagues' comments going back years.
No, but I mean, I'm not asking you to answer for colleagues' comments. I'm asking you to accept the analysis that Help to Buy scheme. It is those colleagues are not the only people who analysed the Help to Buy scheme and saw what it was doing, which was pricing other people out of the market. It's fine if you're the person who gets it, but you're driving up prices for everything else.
I think my own view on the Help to Buy scheme is that it's such a minor part of housing policy. There's so low numbers engaging in it that it's not having a massive impact either way.
I heard it mentioned about 5 times yesterday by various governments.
That's not the core housing policy. That's not the big ticket issue.
These quotes are from housing spokespersons and finance spokespersons at a time that Fianna Fáil, and they're telling us now, well, look, we weren't in government, but they promised us housing budgets. They were talking about the influence they were having, and they were bragging about, like, I mean, they're saying now that, oh, well, it takes time and there's only about, I don't know, about a dozen affordable houses being built. But we had 5 years of Fianna Fáil in confidence and supply bragging about we're going to deliver this housing budget through confidence and supply, and it never happened. Yeah. And we're still dealing with a legacy of a decade of failing to deal with this crisis at this stage.
I'm going to let Hugh get in because he was trying to get in, then I'll let you in, Catherine.
Yeah, no, just to make the point, like, the analysis in 2016 and 2017 by Barry Cowan and Michael McGrath, you know, was entirely accurate because, I mean, it has had an inflationary effect on house prices. And I believe, and I don't have the numbers to hand, but there are statistics out there that there are an awful lot of people that are using the scheme that don't actually need it. I think Piers Doherty, in fact, quoted some of these statistics in the launch of Sinn Féin's alternative budget last week. So, you know, there is a question to be asked about the effectiveness of the policy and whether it's the right policy to help people to get onto the housing ladder, and whether it's helping the people that really need it the most, the people who, as I highlighted earlier, paying exorbitant rents and can't afford to save for a mortgage.
Yeah, Catherine Connolly.
On that specific point, this scheme was announced in 16, introduced in 17. It has cost 4 times greater than the original estimate of the 40 million. It looks like it will cost 170 million in this year. In addition, it's for houses up to 500,000, but exceptions have been made of up to 600,000. So this is a Help to Buy scheme for houses that cost 500,000 and up to 600,000. And it has been championed as a major part of the housing policy to help people to own their own house.
Yes, I heard it mentioned several times. Every time somebody was asked yesterday on the government side, as why is there nothing in this for renters, the Help to Buy scheme was mentioned. This is to help those renters to get on the housing ladder.
It has helped some people. to get a home. That's, I mean, that's the facts that people have utilised it. And look, at I think with the housing...
It has gone into developers' pockets, surely. That's what has happened. If it has increased house prices...
But ultimately what's increased house prices, I think people will accept, is the fact that there aren't enough houses. And supply is ultimately the issue.
That's like, also
so that is
well,
why
though.
We shouldn't
that
have a Help to Buy scheme in the middle.
Well, that is why we need to focus on building houses. And that's what the Housing for All policy and plan is about. And that's what the 4 billion investment in housing is
that's
about.
Not,
actually building
that's
homes.
Not accurate now. That's not accurate. The reason we don't have houses is because the government has failed to build any houses through their local authorities up to 2016. I sat on a local authority and the building stopped in 2009. Not a single public house was built. To this day, we still haven't an audit of public land, which the Land Development Agency was to do well before it was put on a statutory footing. We are not committing to building public housing on public land. We are going to build private housing on public land. And so we're continuing with the failed market. And even worse than that, we're now giving public land over for private development. That has huge consequences for keeping the prices artificially high. In addition, over a billion alone is going to happen, which is straight into the landlord's pocket. So when we talk about public housing, we have to stop being dishonest about that, or disingenuous, let me put it like that. Not yourself, Elisa, but generally in relation to, we're mixing up deliberately public housing and private housing, and there's
I'm being told I need to, am I taking a break? Yeah, we'll take a break there because I want to go to the protocol after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, the European Commission has said its proposals to ease the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol will cut checks and controls on a range of retail goods by 80%. In a statement this evening, the British government said it is studying the detail and will, of course, look at them seriously and constructively. DUP leader Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, however, has described the latest proposals as the EU's starting point, but said that on first inspection they would appear to fall far short of the fundamental change needed. And I just want to have a listen as well. Doug Beattie was on Drive Time with Sarah McInerney this evening, and she was pushing him on, you know, whether or not that European Court of Justice issue was something that really made a difference to the man on the street in Northern Ireland. And here's what he said.
Above all else, I'm concerned about the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. I'm worried about relationships between people in this part of this island, this part of the United Kingdom. And that's what's concerning me. Because you know what? A brick will turn into a petrol bomb. A petrol bomb will turn into a coffin. And I don't want to see that.
And that was Doug Beattie earlier. Lisa... It's very hard to know where this is going to go now, because I think what that Lisbon speech from David Frost threw a lot of people.
It did, and I think the timing of it. I mean, the day before Commissioner Šefčovič was to publish his papers, that he'd spent, you know, months engaging with citizens and stakeholders and businesses in Northern Ireland, listening to the UK as well, and taking on board the views of the Irish government. I think making that speech in Lisbon the day before the proposals are even on the table looked like an outright rejection, or basically, if we don't get this, we're not happy. And you know, the European Court of Justice issue that has cropped up relatively last minute, if I can put it that way.
Well, no, they have mentioned it. Fair that it was in their command paper in July.
They have mentioned it, but equally, it was also in the Northern Ireland Protocol when they pored over it for a very long time and signed it eyes wide open, and they knew exactly what they were signing. So that issue, the ECJ was already built in. And in any event, they know that when you have the customs union and the single market, the final place where those issues are determined is by the European Court of Justice, because it's EU law. And they know this.
We can know all of this all we want.
They know it's a red line.
We can know that they know. But what they're telling us now is that it has to... It has to go.
And they know it's a red line for the European Union. They know that. So I would question... And, you know, we all knew really when Michael Gove was taken out as Brexit minister and he was replaced with David Frost, or Lord Frost, as they do call him, you know, it was obvious what that was about. You know, they're very different in how they approach the issue.
What was it about? Just spell it out.
Well, David Frost is considered somebody that's very hardline Brexiteer, maybe not as solutions focused as Gove might have been. And, you know, it's not unsurprising that he made this speech a day in advance of when the proposals were actually tabled. So, yeah, I think... I'm not panicking at this stage. I think we've been here before. We've had lots of cliff edges. We've had lots of tensions created. But the question that everyone's asking, you know, has anybody on the island of Ireland ever mentioned the ECJ as being a big issue? I don't think they have. You know, the engagement that Mara Sefcovic has had in Northern Ireland has been really about the bread and butter stuff of day-to-day living for businesses and citizens, things like SBS, medicines, customs, making trade flow.
Put it from their point of view, right, and just say, We heard from the European Commission, the line since the signing of this protocol was, look, that's it. You've signed up. That's all we can do. We've done as much as we can. Mm-hmm. It turns out that wasn't all they could do. So surely, you know, there is a point to be made that knowing how this was affecting businesses across Northern Ireland, that the European Commission should have come up with these solutions sooner, surely.
Well, so sometimes in these things, because it hasn't happened before, we haven't had a member state leave before, sometimes you're not able to foresee all the possible issues that might arise. I think credit to the European Union. You know, they've acknowledged, okay, there are some difficulties, some teething problems, and they're saying that there are available flexibilities we can use to try and make this work more smoothly. What they're not saying is that they're going to reopen the agreement or renegotiate the agreement. But what they
Jeffrey Donaldson will say, I'll bring in Dunnock on this one, because Jeffrey Donaldson will say that this is his big win so far, that he has brought them back to the negotiating table, and this is a good start, as he would put it.
Look, I mean, it's been our position, and it's been the position of the Irish government that, if there are issues to be resolved, then they can be resolved. My understanding of the European position all along was that the agreement, writ large, was done, but that there could be work done on elements of the protocol and the elements of East-West trade as well as North-South. Look, to be honest, I don't know if it can be said enough Brexit is a terrible idea. It's bad. It's bad for Britain, I believe, very likely, but it's certainly going to be have an impact on the North. And what the protocol is about mitigating that. And to be honest, there is a concerted attempt to exaggerate grossly opposition to the protocol in the North. The protocol has wide cross-community support. It has wide support across business. It's facilitating many businesses in doing and we want to solve those problems, but it was facilitating many businesses in doing things that they could not do in Britain. And that is the reality. If there are issues to be worked through, then that's important. But, what needs to stop here now is people playing politics. And whether that's a British government being obsessed with some sort of EU bogeyman or the DUP looking over their shoulder at the TUV,
Catherine Connolly, does it suit Boris Johnson through David Frost to have this ongoing issue with the European Commission? To have it rumble on, because you know it's everyone needs a war. Every prime minister needs a war, and this is Boris Johnson's war.
Well, we certainly don't need wars, actually.
But you know what I mean by that. Behind you.
Yeah, it's difficult to understand. It seems to me that the Commission are bending over backwards, maybe belatedly, to come up with ideas, to come up with practical solutions to this. But I must say, when I heard Dominic Cummings say that England never intended to comply with the protocol.
Yeah, we always intended to get ditch bits we didn't like after whacking Corbyn. That was the tweet from Dominic Cummings.
Was that it?
Yeah.
I understood his comment was that we were never serious about the protocol. Or that Boris Johnson was never serious about it. It reminded me of my school days of perfidious Albion when I heard it. Perhaps that's not totally fair, but I was up in Derry recently, actually, and it was a lovely experience and a very moving experience, and it brought home to me what we have done with Northern Ireland historically, and we've actually cut off part of our body in a sense psychologically, and I think it's very important that we move to sort of coax and cajole people in Northern Ireland and to help them to realise the opportunities that are there in terms of working with us, and also their unique position now in being in the single market while still being part of the UK. And that's really the challenge for us.
Can I just play you what you mentioned Dominic Cummings and that tweet and the response to that. This is Leo Varadkar this morning referencing what his reaction to that tweet was.
What Dominic Cummings now is saying is that this is a country that makes treaties, that strikes agreements, and then intends to renege on them. And that message must now resonate around the world. Don't make any agreement with the British government. Don't sign any treaty with the United Kingdom until you can be confident that this is a country that can honour its promises.
Hugh, I think maybe a lot of people might have read that tweet and thought exactly the same thing, but is it wise for the Taoiseach to be making statements like that as we're about to, you know, enter into negotiations?
Yeah, well, I mean, there does seem to be a conscious effort on the part of the government to ramp up the rhetoric. If you look at Simon Coveney's
tweet over
the weekend that prompted a response from Lord Frost, that kind of approach is, well, it's risky, but it's part of a pattern, I think, of Brexit over the last 5 years, where the rhetoric does get ramped up and people talk about, you know, there's red lines and hard lines. And then eventually there is much brinkmanship, much delay, extensions, and then there's an agreement. And, you know, my experience of covering Brexit over the last 5 years is it usually involves the UK folding in some shape or form. I mean, the very existence of the protocol in the first place would indicate that, you know, the UK folded to some respect on that, and the fact that the ECJ is in the protocol, something that from the very start of the Brexit process, the UK were extremely anxious to get out of the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice, and then that would have included Northern Ireland, but they ended up allowing the ECJ into the protocol, and now they want to rewrite the whole thing because they say that's part of the bigger problem. But I think Lisa touches on the point that I think is kind of the main point of the EU and of the Irish government, is that no one in Belfast or Larne is talking about the ECJ. They're just talking about the delays that are arising out of, and the issues that are arising out of these checks. And the proposal from the EU on the face of it seems to be one that isn't going down particularly well in all of the EU capitals. And I was reading this morning that there was a lot of cajoling to try and get everyone on board with this proposal from Maros Sefcovic. But it appears to be an offer that the UK is now studying, at least. And if Geoffrey Donaldson is saying it's an opening offer, I mean, at least creates some bit of ground for a negotiation going forward in the next few weeks. But I think this will be long, protracted, drawn out, lots of brinkmanship, you know, maybe one side walking away one way, shape or form. But eventually there'll be some sort of compromise worked out.
Lisa Chambers.
Yeah, look, I think domestically it plays well in the UK. It plays well for Boris Johnson to have this big fight with the EU on a regular basis, and it maybe distracts from other things happening domestically for them.
Yeah, that's what I mean. As Kat said, poor choice of words under the circumstances, but you know what I mean about that
ultimately
sense of, you know, you need something to rally the
they need an
force
enemy
behind
domestically,
exactly,
yeah. And that plays well domestically for them. They can't afford a full-blown trade war. They really can't. They're hurting currently. Things are not working out well for them on the Brexit front, and they know that. And I think Maros Sefcovic and his proposals, he's come a long way. What they have offered is substantial. It is a significant offering, and I think it really shows that you were serious about resolving this.
But actually, I saw this. I can't remember what commentator in the UK made this point, but it's extraordinary how we have gone in the space of a few years from where nobody's talking about leaving the single market to we can survive a trade war with the EU. It has been an extraordinary journey
like the UK are very well aware that if that got to a trade war, the EU would win that because they're much bigger and they're in a better space to do that, but they don't want to do that. And in terms of the process, what could be lying ahead, you know, if it does enter into the dispute resolution mechanism that's built into the withdrawal agreement, you're looking at maybe 12 months to getting a final decision, and ironically ultimately it's the ECJ that decides. So the very issue that they're having problems over, the ECJ is the final arbiter for the withdrawal agreement. And if that doesn't satisfy you, you basically have a trade war, which I don't believe we'll ever get there. I really don't.
But you do completely discount what Doug Beattie was saying this evening, that, you know, a brick can become a petrol bomb, can become, you know, that this could all fall apart.
I was disappointed with those comments, to be honest. I thought that they were a bit inflammatory, really. You know, he's in the job relatively recently and he's made some sensible sounds. Perhaps he is also a bit intimidated by the polling that the TUV is doing. But to be honest, we're looking to get the Assembly recalled between now and the weekend. And the reason we want to do that is we want the message to go out that the majority in the Assembly support the protocol. The majority in the North support the protocol. And sometimes it's getting lost. And there are reasons for that, and people are distorting it. Even within unionism, opposition to the protocol is muted and minimal. And within the business community, people recognise the benefits it has. Not that it's perfect, but certainly relative to the situation in Britain and how it mitigates that.
Do you think it'll get sorted, Catherine?
I think so. I think there's going to be a practical solution to this.
Okay. We've only 1 minute left. Hugh, if you reckon it's we'll have to go through the motions, but ultimately.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, that's just based on, you know, Brexit over the last 5 years has been a lot of brinkmanship and going through the motions. But eventually, there's some sort of compromise, and as I said before, it does usually involve the UK giving in some way, shape, or form. That's my experience of covering it, and that's okay. What I expect to happen in this instance as well.
Okay, we will leave it there. I just have the Irish Examiner's head front page from tomorrow in front of me. Everard case prompts Garda review is the headline there. And they also have another headline, doubts over full reopening on October 22nd as cases spike. That was our discussion from earlier. That's all we have time for. I want to thank my guests. I want to thank you all for listening. And to our production team for all their hard work tonight. Stay tuned for Cathal Murray on Late Date. Oh, I was told I have one last tweet I should bring you. The best thing about watching late debate on the telly is that the politicians mostly forget they're on video, says Donald Griffin. So I don't know what any of you were doing, but he obviously forgot you were on video.
Maybe he can let us know what we were doing.
We'll hand over now to Michael Corcoran on the sports desk.